Legendary doesn't happen by chance. It happens because it's what BetMGM does. Sign up for BetMGM and check out all the exciting new ways you can make this pro football season unforgettable. Shoot your shot with same-game parlays. Call your plays like a pro with live betting. Or bet on a market you didn't know existed thanks to BetMGM Originals. You'll be on the edge of your seat from the very first snap, no matter what type of fan you are. Earn BetMGM rewards points on every bet. Take advantage of football offers found nowhere else, like a second chance on a first touchdown bet. And keep an eye out for rewards dropping in your account throughout the season. Never settle for the ordinary. Sign up today. BetMGM. Make it legendary.
BetMGM and GameSense remind you to play responsibly. See BetMGM.com for terms. 21 plus only. Specific promotional offers are not available in Mississippi, New York, Nevada, Ontario, or Puerto Rico. Gambling problem? Call 1-800-GAMBLER. Available in the U.S. For New York, call 877-8-HOPE-NY or text OPENY 467-369. For Arizona, 1-800-NEXT-STEP. For Massachusetts, 1-800-327-5050. For Iowa, 1-800-BETS-OFF. For Puerto Rico, 1-800-981-0023. Subject to eligibility requirements. In partnership with Kansas Crossing Casino and Hotel.
Welcome back, everybody, to another episode of Positively Trek. I am just one of your hosts, Dan Gunther, and with me this week, as he always is the wonderful Barry DeFord, whom history will paint in glowing colors, I think. Barry, how's it going today?
Glowing, I would say there might be a few light bulbs that are broken in that respect. The marquee won't be that fancy when my names are put up in lights. My epitaph, I hope, will be, I did my best.
That is a great epitaph, and yeah. One I feel like we can all aspire to.
Yeah, really. Yeah. That, or I told you I was sick.
I like it. Yeah. Yeah. And I mean, what person in all of history is not going to have a few things that color their margin on one side or the other, right? So interesting thoughts to keep in our head as we head into this next episode, which, you know, folks might be wondering, we're done Strange New World. Season 3 is in the rearview mirror now, and we have much more Star Trek on television to look forward to coming up next year. But before we get there, we have some other Star Trek that is currently in production, or currently coming out, sorry. And we are going to talk about it. So we are going to be talking about Star Trek Con, the currently ongoing dramatic podcast series. So we have two episodes out at this point, and we're going to talk about both of them. So Barry, how excited are you to jump into Star Trek Con?
I'm extremely excited, Dan. And I guess, like, maybe this is somewhat self-serving, as this is our medium, the talking. I know some people see our lovely faces on the YouTubes and stuff like that, but I mean, our home is in the podcast land. You know, we've mm-hmm. been doing this, you and I both, for a considerably long time, and I've always had a thing for it. I mean, full disclosure, everybody, I have a bit of a old-timey side of me. I used to be a historical interpreter at Fort Edmonton Park, and I was a interpreter on 1920 Street, and that's when the radio play really kind of hit its zenith, I guess you could say, up into from the 20s to like the 50s or so, you would see these radio plays, and I gotta say, there's just something magical about them. I really love them. I mean, they can really stir people up too. I'm often reminded, I don't know if anyone's ever done this before, but if you ever get time, listen to Orson Welles' rendition of War of the Worlds, the original mm-hmm. radio play. It's harrowing. It's harrowing.
It's so good.
And then, I mean, I have always found, and I think you can agree with me, Stuart MacLean in the Vinyl Cafe.
Oh, yes. Yes. Any Canadian listener is going to know exactly what you're talking about.
And American or international listeners, I'm sure you can find him somewhere. Just everyone look up Dave Cooks the Turkey.
Oh, man. Listen to it at Thanksgiving. You will not regret it.
Yeah. Oh, man. What an episode. So I think I'm kind of primed for this medium. So some people it might not be their cup of tea, right? There's no visual effects to any of this. But I honestly think that the work they put in, the actors they got, and the way this story plays out, the pacing, everything about it is just fantastic. So I guess I might sound a bit sycophantic, but it's because I kind of am. I love radio plays. These are great. So yeah, this is right up there for me. The first two episodes, I got to say, they slap, man. They're great. I love them.
Yeah, absolutely. Well, I love you framing it as a radio play as well, because everything old is new again, right? It's true in the world of fashion. It's true in the world of entertainment, right? The old radio serials like you're talking about, I've seen so many people commenting online like, oh, it's nice to see Star Trek break into this new exciting frontier. And there's like inevitably the older folks replying like, no, what are you talking about?
Yeah, no, radio plays have been a thing for for way longer. I mean, one time a long time ago, they called movies with sound talkies, and then they just became movies again. So that's just that, right?
Exactly. Well, let's I kind of wanted to start us off by giving just a brief history of this project, Star Trek Con. So in May of 2018, Star Trek Con was kind of half announced as this project that Nicholas Meyer was working on. And he said at the time he was working on a standalone Star Trek related trilogy that would later be revealed to be a 3-episode miniseries titled SETI Alpha 5. Now, 2018, if you cast your mind back there, Star Trek Discovery had come out in the year before. So Star Trek Con essentially was the second television thing talked about. This was before Picard, before Strange New Worlds, before Lower Decks, before Prodigy, before any of that, right? So it's kind of interesting. We're finally getting this in the form that it's in. But there were a few stumbling blocks to that happening. First of all, apparently the fact that the television and film franchises were split at the time between Viacom and CBS was a bit of a stumbling block. Of course, your choice would be like, if you're going to do a television thing, you could only use stuff from the Space Seed and not from Wrath of Khan, right? So that was a big thing. Those got back together and they merged again. So that was not an issue, but there were issues with Paramount feeling that the cost maybe outweighed what they would get from just 3 episodes of something. So it was kind of put in development hell for a little bit. But in 2022, the project came back when Nick Meyer revealed that he was negotiating a deal to turn SETI Alpha 5 into a podcast that he would write and possibly direct. And in September of that year, Meyer officially announced it as the scripted podcast Star Trek Con SETI Alpha 5. So a nice big long title that would eventually get shrunk back down 3 years later in February of 2025 as Star Trek Con, written by Kirsten Beyer and David Mack, based on the story by Nicholas Meyer and directed by Fred Greenhall. We had the casting announced in February 2025, and we'll get into the cast as we talk about the actual episodes, with additional casting revealed in July. And then, of course, we got that wonderful little trailer at San Diego Comic-Con this year. And on Star Trek Day 2025, September 8th, Star Trek Con hit our podcatchers and life as we know it was forever changed.
It's been a long road getting from there to here, but I'm glad we're here now. Dan,
you're here.
This is a star-studded writing cast. Mm-hmm. Nick Meyer, Kirsten Beyer, David Mack, directed by Fred Greenhall. I am so excited to see these folks, and they honestly, the first two episodes, and again, sycophants, this is positively Trek. We were allowed to be happy. The actors that they chose as well, I was wondering a little bit about their choice for Khan. But they've done a good job. He's got the right accent, right? A little less of the Ricardo Montalban kind of sound to him, but I'll take it because he really sells. He sells Khan for me. I like the way in which they use a lot of the sound effects. You kind of feel like you're there, right? When they're in more closed spaces, I don't know what they're doing, but I feel like it's a little bit closed. There are some scenes that they're out in the forest doing stuff. They add a lot of really good ambient noise, and it's mixed extremely well. These are little things that we podcasters like because we like leveled sound. We don't like one person overpowering the other. We like nice mics, all that sort of stuff. Listen to this with headphones on, folks. do yourself a favor. I know some, like I had to listen to the first episode in the car, but this, I came back and I listened to it again with my big headphones on, and what a tasty treat that was.
I'm kind of jealous. I have had to listen to both of these episodes in my work vehicle that is assigned to me by the place where I work, and the speakers from years of what I can only assume are abuse by the person who had the vehicle before me. The speakers are not great, but I can imagine that that's a great suggestion to really give you that immersive feeling for sure.
I hate to, this is going to old man me up really good. Get some chocolate dipped digestive cookies, make some chamomile tea, lay down on your favorite couch or love seat or reclinable chair, put the big headphones on, turn on Star Trek Con and kiss the sky. It's a great night.
I'm sorry. Did you say kiss this guy?
Sure. Thanks, Mr. Oh my.
Oh my. Oh my.
Oh my.
Speaking of oh my. Yes.
Speaking of indeed, yes.
Well, let's jump right in here then to episode one, Paradise, which dropped on September 8th. Now, all of these episodes are written, as I said, by Kirsten Beyer and David Mack, from a story by Nicholas Meyer. And we start with this framing story. And through the dialogue, we learn this is 3 months after the beginning of Generations. So Kirk has been, quote, dead for about 3 months. And we have this committee basically to fund or support civilian scientific research missions that Dr. Lear, an historian, is appealing to. She wishes to go to SETI Alpha 5 to investigate the possibility of record tapes made by Lieutenant Marla MacGyver's following her and Khan's exile there with the augments that were rescued from the Botany Bay by Kirk in Space Seed. And So where this is in the timeline, of course, places it well after we know how that all turned out, right? Yes. SETI Alpha 6 exploded, which shifted SETI Alpha 5's orbit and turned it into a wasteland. And Khan, driven by murderous revenge at the death of his wife, commandeers the USS Reliant and hunts down Kirk, and we all know that movie.
He'll follow him to, yeah.
Yeah. I'll chase him round the moons of Nibia and round Perdition's flames and round the Antares maelstrom before I give him up. Sorry. Don't get me quoting Wrath of Khan. I'll just go to town. So yeah, we know how that has all turned out, how history has painted Khan and from what we know of him and stuff. And Dr. Lear's whole thing is, what we know about him is very limited. We've just seen these very narrow slices of the whole person that is Khan. And she kind of wants to explore that and figure that out. And hopefully these record tapes will allow her to do so. And enter in this moment, Captain Hikaru Sulu. First of all, how great was it to hear Captain Sulu in... You know, with Lower Decks being over, he had a brief kind of cameo in that show, but honestly, this might very well be the last official time we hear George Takei playing Hikaru Sulu.
Don't say that.
If it is, though, I'm okay with he blessed us with this. This was unexpected. We knew a few months ago that he was going to be in it, but it was unexpected when they announced it that we would be getting more Sulu. So I thought this was great.
It is. And he comes in very well. He has a very commanding performance. I think he is very good as the kind of the bridge to get them to SETI Alpha 5. I think that's the best piece of all this. I love the fact that, you know, we get some more Captain Sulu. Yeah, I like him. I like the fact that he's got a fair bit of agency, and he's at the helm. He's in the captain's chair, not just the helm. Goodness me.
Yeah, it's wonderful to hear him, and he makes a nice entrance, I think, by basically being the witness who was there for Khan, right? As he says, one of the few people still alive who actually met Khan, right?
Mm-hmm.
So it's interesting that we get his take on this, and he eventually agrees to take Dr. Lear on this expedition to SETI Alpha 5 after her kind of impassioned words, which were interesting as well.
Yeah, she doesn't pull punches.
No. So what do we think about Dr. Lear? She's a little bit antagonistic. She kind of feels like there's an inherent bias against Khan, and I, she's not wrong. I don't think she's wrong. But interestingly, also, she's holding stuff back from this committee as well, because she has some bits of tapes that were given to her by a source. We don't know who that source is. And she's heavily redacted them before letting the committee kind of hear them. More to come on that, I'm sure. I'm curious what I kind of get a bit of what her motivation is here, but I'm curious. There's more to it than that, I sense.
Well, yeah, and they set up a lot of good threads here that now we've got some mysteries that we've got to solve. I think what we get mostly from Dr. Lear here is, you're right, she wants to believe in what she's arguing for. But I also think she has a bit of maybe something of a person who deeply studies history can sometimes become enthralled with the characters of history that they look back at. And history itself, I'll say, as a social studies teacher, history is more of a reflection of the present than it is a total account of the past. And we always have to make sure that we are being, you know, passionate. And it's good to be passionate about history. Absolutely it is. But I think in Dr. Lear, she's been compromised a little bit by what she has learned. And I've been compromised in the past by what I've learned, and I've had to kind of come back to it later in a much more pragmatic sense. So I'm excited for what will be revealed here moving forward. Mm-hmm. But I like that she's kind of a jerk. she just goes for it, you know?
Yeah, the interesting moment to me, and the kind of gasp that the committee lets out and Sulu does, how dare you, when she says she feels that it's a distinct possibility that Kirk knew that SETI Alpha 6 was unstable and before dropping Khan and the survivors off there, right? And that maybe this was all the plan from the beginning. Insulting our hero there, right? Like, kind of, it's an interesting way to introduce the character. And I was kind of reminded a bit of Deep Space Nine introducing Sisko by having him be really angry at Jean-Luc Picard, who's our hero, right? So it's a great way to get the audience to care about something.
Right. I'm not a big fan of Winston Churchill. Mm-hmm. And my family, who has very deep English roots, my grandma basically thought he did no wrong. And this would have been about half a decade ago at this point. I was at the dinner table around and Churchill came up and I had some words for him. And I remember some family members really jumped down my throat over it. And I had to hit them back with the Bengal famine. I had to hit them back with stuff. And I mean, Churchill had some interesting turns of phrase and stuff like that. But what he said about the people of Palestine, what he said about the Bengalis, what he said about indigenous people, the list goes on. He was not a good man. And if we alienate any listeners, I mean, if you want, I can send you some history. Just let me know and I can hook you up with that. And I'm not trying to make people hate someone in history. He is a character of history. He's an interesting character of history, but he wasn't perfect. And I think Lear's little jab at Kirk indicates that there is a little bit of Kirk can do no wrong kind of feel to that too. And that's not, that's not true. I mean, Kirk was a flawed individual. So was Bill Shatner. Here we are, right?
And I find that interesting that given where it is in the timeline too, it's just the beginning of Kirk becoming an historical figure rather than a contemporary figure, right? That's, it's an interesting time. And so there's the writing on this is really slick because there's so many parallels being set up. What we're saying about Kirk is a lot of the stuff that we might be saying about Khan in this episode, and especially the second episode, which gets into some really interesting stuff. But also, I think Lear is very much paralleling Lieutenant Marla MacGyver's as well. Yeah. Yeah. Marla MacGyver's is like the quintessential character who is seduced by history and, you know, let history kind of get to her and influence her in a way that maybe was not the most professional. You know, it's interesting seeing, well, I'll stick a pin in that because I have some interesting things to say about MacGyver's and the way this series so far portrays her as well.
Yeah. She's a lot more dynamic in this.
Yes. Yeah. We will get there. Absolutely. Yeah. I do want to just talk, a little bit about Lear still, because if we're kind of starting off maybe a little bit opposed to her at this beginning part here, she does make a pretty impassioned speech and causes Sulu to kind of look inside himself and say, well, these are actually interesting questions and I am interested in finding out the answer to this. And I think we and she deserves to know the answer to that. So he will take her on this expedition. Jumping ahead to when they're on SETI Alpha 5, Dr. Lear and a certain young Vulcan ensign played perfectly by Tim Russ. He sounds exactly like he did back in the day. And I buy him as young Tuvok.
Tim Russ, man.
Oh, so
love
good.
Love that guy.
Absolutely. But the one thing I just want to, about Dr. Lear before we talk about that is, I kind of get on her side a little bit more when we hear the joy, the crack of joy in her voice as she realizes that not only do these tapes that they find there, are not only recorded by Marla MacGyver's, but they are actual firsthand primary source documents as she hears the voice of Khan Noonien Singh talking about his exile on SETI Alpha 5. As someone, and here I go into my Willem Dafoe voice, I'm somewhat of a student of history myself. I the joy in her voice at finding primary documents like that, that's huge. And I love that.
Absolutely. I've had that happen to me. My grandmother wrote a diary in the 1940s. And after she passed away, I found it.
And what a treasure.
Oh man. And it is, it's in the hands of my cousins right now. We're passing it around the family so everyone can get a chance to read it. But my favorite part is reading her account from the 1940s and her accounting her life and getting to know her as a young woman. Very fascinating. But my favorite part is in the mid 20 teens, my grandma went back into her diary and corrected herself. She argues with herself.
Wow.
She writes again from the perspective of a woman who is beginning to suffer from dementia. Not to get too heavy here, but she knew. And I think that's why she went into her diaries, because she was afraid of losing. And she begins correcting herself. She begins saying, well, this is actually what ends up happening. And I was wrong to feel this way. And so it's interesting seeing her have a conversation with herself, a kind of double primary document. So, yeah. Getting it from the actual hand of the person, it's unbeatable. So yeah, I'm there with Dr. Lear when she hears Khan's voice there.
Yeah, that was a moment that I loved. I loved that for sure. Oh, what a great story! That's incredible about your grandmother's diary. That's amazing.
Yeah, it's fun.
Oh, so cool.
When it cycles back around to me, I'll show it to you.
Yeah. Oh, I would love that. Yeah. That's amazing. So Tuvok, yeah, Tim Russ, another big Trek alum returning here. Interestingly, like there's moments here where Dr. Lear has feelings about Starfleet. It's kind of obvious. And Tuvok, as the officer in the room with her, I guess, kind of is Starfleet's face back to her a little bit. And is defending this organization that he's chosen to be a part of. And interestingly, where we are in Tuvok's journey is very soon at some point, he's going to leave Starfleet for 50 years because he can't stand it anymore.
Right.
Which is interesting. And I don't imagine we're going to really get into that with this, but you never know. We might see a little bit of that. I think there's a lot of really interesting things happening with these characters, whether the writers are intending to explore that or not. If you're big into and deep into Star Trek lore, you got to know there's a lot going on here with these guys.
And that's what I like about the writing here. You know, this is why I'm saying it's in such good hands, because we've got people who really do have an intimate relationship. Some of these people have had a very long pedigree working with the story and building it to where it's at. And I think, you know, they're aware of all these little aspects. And those of us who do have that kind of more intimate relationship with being Star Trek fans for so long, it's lovely to see. I think even, and correct me if I'm wrong, Dr. Leary even kind of brings up like Tuvok's promise as a Starfleet officer. She kind of talks about like his acumen and he's got places to go. And I'm like, he ain't going to go too far. He's going to leave. And then he's going to get stuck in the Delta Quadrant.
Yeah. And then he's going to become a captain that gets replaced by a changeling for a little while. But
heavens.
Thankfully, he's okay.
Yeah. Well, that was a little freaky. I was like, oh no, they just killed Tuvok.
Yeah.
But no, thankfully.
Yep. Nope. He's okay. He got better.
Yeah.
Speaking of historians and defending Starfleet, there's an interesting bit here too, where they talk about Marla MacGyver's, and Dr. Lear correctly, I think, points out that Marla MacGyver's was a lieutenant in Starfleet and should be afforded that respect. And Tuvok has a bit of an opposing view, saying that, mm-hmm. you know, she forfeited that when she went with Khan and his followers. And I think it's interesting because they both have good points, I think.
Yeah.
Which leads me into wanting to talk a little bit about Marla MacGyver's and the complicatedness of this character, more so, I think, than we got in the original episode. Madeline Rue played her in TOS in Space Seed and puts in a command performance. She's really good. But there is an aspect to the character that, written as a 1960s female character in a show written and produced and starring men, you know, she doesn't have a lot of agency in that episode, with a couple exceptions that I think I'll bring up in the second episode, because it comes out a little bit in that episode. But here she's portrayed very differently. The character is written very differently here, but I think necessarily so. She was a historian. She is a historian as we see her here. And she is a professional scientist in the historical sciences and a Starfleet officer. And I think the writers here do a much greater service to her character than the writer in 1966 did.
Yeah. I mean, what I would say is the palette of the Star Trek fan, especially, has progressed. And if they were to have portrayed her, they wouldn't have been able to give her as much to do. So what they've done to make MacGyver's have more agency, I think, tracks. And do we have to require a certain suspension of disbelief there to some degree? I don't know. She, again, second episode, she mentions more about her life on the Enterprise, and it doesn't sound like she was afforded much agency, right? Sounds like she was working. She had a job and she did the job and that was it. Which always makes me wonder, you know, like if you're just some person on the Enterprise and they're getting attacked by a giant green hand or something, like, what do? Just go to your job? Like, these things can happen. So yeah, no, I think they rightly so afford her a lot more agency, and it matches the palette that we have today for Star Trek storytelling.
And I would also say that there is more continuity between the original portrayal and this portrayal by Ren Schmidt, who does an amazing job here, by the way. I love Ren Schmidt.
Yeah.
Then some people online are giving this show credit for. We only see basically a little tiny slice of her life in Space Seed. And imagine you're an historian who, you know, is passionate about certain things in the past, and then a literal character from that past steps off the transporter pad and comes into your life. I'm willing to grant her a little bit of acceptance that she was overwhelmed and You know what I mean? Starstruck. And yeah, I mean, I can reconcile the two performances is what I'm saying for sure.
Yeah. Now she's had some time to think. She's had some time to kind of process what exactly has happened. And yeah, you're going to think a little differently. And it's clear that she's like, they write her. She's got a little bit of a side plan here. And I appreciate that.
Yeah, a little post-mutiny clarity, if you will. From here, let's jump into the main story, because we've got, once we find these primary documents, we jump into the past on SETI Alpha 5, basically moments after the exile has begun, right? They've been left here on SETI Alpha 5. And we get to know Khan a little bit as he is in this setting. Now, Naveen Andrews, I have to say, I love his performance as Khan. I am actually thrilled that he is not trying to do Ricardo Montalban as Khan and bringing his own to it. He's got just hints of that, but bringing his own to the character and making that character his own. I love it. I was sold 2 minutes into it.
I also ignored any differences. I mean, like I've said, you know, Ricardo Montalban is just, he's got a way of speaking. He carried that character for decades and he's not with us anymore. And just like, you know, we have new iterations of Uhura, we have new iterations of Kirk and so on, Spock. And I feel like all these actors are putting their all into it. So I'm here for it as well. I think his accent, the gravitas to the way he speaks, he captures all of those pieces. I buy him as Khan. And he is a likable character.
Very charismatic, very likable.
I would give him a chance to talk.
Yeah.
Just the way I'm seeing him as he is. And even, you know, aspects of what, and I don't know if this is the first or the second episode of him, the way he treats the children. And when she spoke about that, that really kind of clicked a little bit for me.
Yeah. So yeah, let's talk about that. That is in the first episode. So okay, we learn
they blended that for me.
So we learned that a lot of the complement of the Botany Bay were children that he liberated, basically, and brought with him. One of them is Joachim,
yeah.
I think, is how it's pronounced, as how Khan says it in Wrath of Khan, who's the son, we learn, of Joaquin, who was Khan's lieutenant from Space Seed. So kind of connecting those little dots that people had questions about for years, right? Like, we never saw any young people among Khan's followers, and now all of a sudden he's surrounded by people 20 years his junior, right? Oh, well, these are all the kids, apparently, that he's brought with him. And interestingly enough, this child is the son, like I said, of Joaquin, but also a normal, an unaugmented human woman. And thus is kind of a target of scorn by other children. But Khan kind of, this is a moment where you kind of come on his side a little bit, where he says in his new society that he's creating, all of his followers are equal and none is superior to anyone else. And they're all his followers, right? And he basically kind of knights this kid as his own, right? So interesting the way he has to kind of create consensus.
Well, yeah. And I think this underscores a certain level of egalitarianism, that sees itself. I like they're in this time, we're kind of getting, Ivan and the others are talking about, I think it was the Siege of Tehran, right? Mm-hmm. Where that's kind of their last stand, but they're talking about cities that they held. We're talking about sort of actions and stuff like that. To some degree, like at this point, I sort of see him something like a Salah ad-Din character, right? If anyone's familiar with the Crusade, Salah ad-Din was the leader of the West Asian fighters, primarily Muslims, who were fighting against the Christian Crusaders. And he gets a bit of a bad rap in earlier iterations of history. But now that we've actually read the accounts, he turns out to be kind of the only adult in the room when it came to all of the people who were doing the Crusade-y stuff. He was the one who was actually freeing prisoners. He was the one who wasn't eating the people he was taking over. My favorite part is he was also a great hero that everybody loved. And there was a point when they asked him if he wanted to come and pray in the Church of the Holy Sepulchre as a Muslim with the Christians. And he said, no, I won't. And they're like, how dare you say no to us? He says, no, if I do, they're going to build a mosque here. So I'm going to go pray outside. And guess where they built a mosque? right there. And so you really do get this egalitarian, maybe a bit more of a level head, and you can kind of see why people would follow him, because he is making kind of reasoned choices and he's saying things that do kind of tug at your empathetic self. Yeah, Joachim is very much a part of this group. And if anyone says otherwise, they get to answer to Khan about it, and they revere him and they respect him. And so he is sort of, he's setting a tone, and I appreciate the tone he sets here because the writers are setting a tone, and I really appreciate that.
Well, they also do it through another scene where we learn of one of Khan's people, Hugo, who is not necessarily on board. He says, you know, we were handed defeat and we had to flee Earth under your rule. And then we were tasked with taking over a starship and you failed at that as well. Why should we follow you now?
Exactly.
And this is interesting. This is a question that I'm sure is on the minds of a lot of other people who aren't speaking up. But again, that charisma is just dialed up to 15 here. And Khan, in a brilliant oration, basically bests Hugo in a battle of wits, right? A gorgeous scene and very well written as well.
Well, and he also appeals to Kirk's logic, right? And I think that's another piece, is Kirk was his enemy, but Khan does not see Kirk as some terrible, tyrannical, he's the enemy, therefore he is bad. He's actually going, my enemy is a smart man. My enemy was a logical man. And this is how it plays out, right? I don't think that we can say that I was bested by this man more than this man knew that I was a threat and I knew that he was a threat. And we both dealt with a threat in a bit more of a pragmatic sense, right? Kirk puts Khan on a hospitable planet. He could have airlocked him, right? You literally have what human beings of that time would have considered one of the worst tyrants of all time. Kirk doesn't kill him.
Yeah.
He could have. Could have put him back on ice and just threw him back off into space too. He didn't.
Well, in the thoughts of Dr. Lear, he maybe did just that, basically.
Yes, but we're going by what Khan is basically saying about the situation here, right?
That's true.
And you're right, he bests Hugo. But I think also in such an early stage, nothing wrong has happened enough, and I think Hugo really jumps the gun here. He does sort of seal his own fate because not enough bad things have happened. They haven't had enough crop. They haven't even started crops yet, right? Crops haven't failed. Nothing's been built. He's doing this way too early. And honestly,
you gotta pick your moment, dude.
Well, yeah. And I was, once he did that, I know Khan's like, you know, walk with me, and they walk and talk. And that was an interesting bit too, because Khan also could have just turned and strangled him to death, but no, he's looking for some kind of compromise, some kind of, you know, peace to keep the peace, I guess is the best way to put it. But knowing the other characters and kind of having an idea for who they were, I was like, oh, Hugo, you cooked, buddy. You done.
See, now that brings me to the next question a little bit, because We'll jump to the end with Hugo then, because he is killed by Ivan at the end of the episode. He's thrown off this mountain, basically. There's a bit of a question, I think, and maybe not, but in my mind, there's a bit of a question. Was Ivan doing that of his own volition, or was Khan ordering him to do that? And the episode doesn't say one way or the other.
I guess that's where we can make our own decisions. And any any big leader, any big leader like this, will possess a certain amount of subtext. And I think this is where we might be able to get into some of the big people of history of, you know, what did they do wrong? What did they do right? And I guess Ivan knows Khan. Khan knows Ivan. So even if Khan didn't order this, he's smart enough to know what actually happened, mm-hmm. right? I think. And the fact that he doesn't go after Ivan means that if he wasn't, we can't implicate him, we can at least consider him culpable.
Mm-hmm.
Right? Because this is how it works, right? This is how it goes. You're in a struggle for survival. Sometimes these things are going to happen, right? You're going to have to shoot some people. You're going to have to break some eggs, right? I always think of when Fidel Castro was being interviewed, I think by Sheila Rogers. It was during Pierre Trudeau's funeral. And Sheila Rogers is dancing around. She's got this interview with Fidel Castro. I think it was Sheila. Please quote me if I'm wrong, but he was being interviewed on the CBC. And he says, as she's kind of dancing around the idea of the Cuban Revolution and the people he killed, he interrupts her. And he's like, I have blood on my hands. I know I do. So please stop dancing around this. I wasn't involved in every kill, but I was the leader. So you can blame me for every single murder. Every single person we shot, I was the leader. So go ahead and blame me. It's fine. I'm at peace with it. And I think that's where we can put Khan.
Makes sense. Yeah, absolutely. I guess we don't know for sure on this case, but
another thread.
It's interesting. And there's a lot of those. And I feel like some of them will be paid off and some of them won't be. And it'll be interesting to see where our thoughts lead us and what's going to happen. Last little bit I want to talk about with this episode, and very quickly. We have the fact that augment women were apparently rendered sterile in all of this genetic engineering, while, of course, the men retain their reproductive abilities to allow for viable gametes, according to the scientists who created them. And there's an interesting line where they said, you know, even though we were defeated, you know, our bloodlines will remain in Earth's population for years to come. And of course, we have Lan Nunian Singh. And I'm also just in my brain a little neurons firing that, like, why is Dr. Lear seeming to be so motivated to assign people in history a bit of a more better place than they've had up to this point? Just something that's
thought of that.
Just a little bell that's kind of ringing in the back of my mind that I'm like, I wonder if that particular bell will get rung again at some point. I don't know. Just a thought. But I did like that pointing that out in this episode very, very specifically, that line that they will continue to. And I don't think it was to explain Lan Nunian Singh. I think there's something else in this story that's going to come from that. But
obliquely, it gets her explained, though.
Yeah, and it does. Yeah, absolutely. And also, this leads the revelation to Marla MacGyver's very viable possible reason why Khan has brought her along. And the scene where she confronts Khan about it, and you think what's immediately going to come is a refutation of that, and that, like, no, I brought you here as my partner and I love you. That doesn't happen. He all but says, yes, that's correct, that's why you're here. And she asks if he's ever loved anybody in his life. And he says something along the lines of, love doesn't build empires.
Yeah. Again, you're dealing with someone who is a world historical figure, right? Mm-hmm. And I think you do have to kind of dispose of that level of sentimentality when you're that large, that big, that gigantic. And I like the fact that actually Khan kind of holds no illusions about that. And I mean, that's hard for, like, the love story of the whole thing, but I think it makes him a lot more believable as a person who took over the planet, right? Mm-hmm. He's got to be a little more cold and calculating in that sense. And he is hedging his bets. I mean, he could have also lied to her and say, no, I love you, you know, like that sort of stuff, but he doesn't. He says, no. Yeah, you are kind of my backup. And I mean, like, that sucks, but it's also like, you're stuck here with us, so I might as well just tell you the truth. Yeah. I mean, again, we get more dialogue later that shows that maybe he does really do harbor feelings for her, but at the same time, there is a functionality to all of this.
During this conversation, just one last little thing I want to bring up, and it's kind of going to feed into our conversation for the next episode as well, which is this discussion of Hernan Cortez and and the story of him scuttling his ships to and reportedly to ensure that his men were properly motivated to fight the Aztecs and all of this stuff. And I love this because when Khan brings it up, as a student of history, I'm kind of going like, you're not really telling the whole story there. And there's a character who's an historian standing there, and she says exactly what is burning through my brain. And I'm just like, slow clap.
Preach,
Kirsten,
sister.
David, and Nick Meyer, whoever. Oh, beautiful. Brilliant.
Brilliant. Yeah. As a person who directly teaches about Hernan Cortez, that man was a monster. He was a genocider. Mm-hmm. He was a demon and a disgrace to humanity.
Yeah.
And I mean that with every fiber of my being. Come at me. There is no redeeming quality to that man.
Absolutely. The fact that there's two things that I wish struck from the record in two of my favorite shows of all time. And that is the name of the Earth Force explorer ship Cortez that visits Babylon 5. Oh, and yeah, the starship Cortez that's in Sisko's fleet to retake Deep Space Nine. It pisses me off that those ships are named that.
Yeah. And if you
Earth Force, I can actually almost forgive a bit more because they do turn into like a fascistic,
yeah,
you know, whatever. Keep it the F out of my Star Trek, please.
Yeah. Or if they're going to do it this way. Right. Mm-hmm. And if you want to know, folks, just look up the Cholula massacre just to start. That is why Montecosuma says you're a very weird man. And it gets translated to you're a god, because the woman who is translating for Cortez, who he is having his way with, I'll just put it that way, knows he's an abuser and doesn't want him to take his anger out on her later. No, Cortez is awful. And I really loved the scene because, yeah, it does enough to like set us up. Like, we're like, oh, come on, you guys should know better. Oh, you do know better. Yay.
Absolutely.
And it also, again, it does something here because look at Khan utilizing people of history and his misunderstanding of those people of history. Mm-hmm. As some kind of archetype. And I love that he gets corrected by some intern from the Enterprise. You know, I don't want to totally belittle her. She was an officer and those sorts of things. But, you know, a very sort of, like, she is not as memorable as Khan, obviously. And I like that she is able to kind of put him in his place with real history. And he doesn't dispute it. I love that.
Yeah. Yeah. And I mean, it's an echo of the Khan that we see in Space Seed as well, right?
Yeah.
Where he talks about Alexander and Napoleon in kind of the same breath as himself. And like, he sees himself as the inheritor of what is reductively in history, great men, right?
Yes.
And I think that's what this series is dealing with a lot of, is the mythology of history, but also the reductive nature of history. And again, like you said, history says more about us now than it does about the past. History is written by the victors is a line that Dr. Lear says, and Lieutenant MacGyver's will say in the next episode as well, mm-hmm. right? So
yeah, exactly.
Listen up, football fans. You won't want to miss this.
Right now, new Bet365 customers bet $5 and get $200 in bonus bets, win or lose. So you could turn that $200 into something bigger when you bet on Moneyline, Spread, Totals, Player Props.
$200 in bonus bets when new customers bet $5. I know where I'm going to bet from now on. Download the app today and see why it's never ordinary at Bet365. Gambling problem? Call 1-800-GAMBLER. 21 plus only. Must be physically located in Ohio. T&Cs apply. In app only.
As always, Positively Trek is brought to you by its Patreon supporters, including Joyce Mirren, Brandy Jackala, Christina DeClercq-Zalagi, John Guppy, Out of Memory, Patrick Carlin, and Ricky Long. If you'd like to support the podcast, visit patreon.com/positivelytrek. You can join at any level and enjoy early access to episodes, ad-free episodes, episode shoutouts, executive producer credits, and more. Again, that's patreon.com/positivelytrek. Thank you so much to those of you supporting us. We truly do appreciate it. And now, back to the show. Which brings us to episode number 2, Scheherazade, which is, I would say, almost the first, like, kind of real episode. Like, if you consider the first one, like, the pilot episode, the introduction, now we're getting into the meat of the story here. So, first of all, when I saw that title, I was like, Scheherazade. And it occurred to me, and I remembered, I'm so happy with myself, having listened to this episode about 10 minutes in. That's where I know that name from. And then, of course, we get the story later in the episode. But Scheherazade, what are your first thoughts on this one?
Well, first of all, when I the way I always remember Scheherazade is "You Ain't Never Got a Friend Like Me" by the genie in Aladdin. Well, Alibaba had them 40 thieves. Scheherazade had 1,000 tales. That's where I first figured that all out. So anyways,
nice.
With that little jingle in my head. This was my favorite episode of the two so far. Like you said, it gets into the meat of the story, and what a meal it is. We really get to know a lot of the people who are building SETI Alpha and setting things up, getting things going, the setbacks, the drawbacks, the interrelationships. There's parts that I don't like about the episode, but that's because I just don't like those aspects. I don't like it when bugs show up.
No, well, we got a lot of
just makes bugs me feel coming. Twitchy. It just makes me feel twitchy. But that's also why I like this episode, is it did actually like viscerally make me uncomfortable later. I liked them just the way they talked about the animals. They really paint a beautiful picture of what this place really is. I kind of imagined it a little more Marsy when I was listening to the first episode. The second episode, they really give a lot of sound quality to it to give it this more temperate forest, maybe temperate rainforest kind of feel to it. Like, I kind of think that we're sort of an East Coast version of the California redwood forest in a lot of ways, with bugs, big bugs and dinosaurs, or kind of dinosaurs. So yeah, I like what they do with the characters. I like the fact that they have Princess Mononoke sized boars here. That's really interesting. And if you haven't seen, I guess that might be a deep cut for some of you. There's a Japanese movie called Princess Mononoke, and the animals are really big. Anyways, there you go.
Explain a movie badly.
Right? With Barry. And I do like also, they go a little more deeper with Marla, especially about Khan and how he's portrayed in history and how he is looked at in history, because he gets the big old rubber stamp evil demon. And seconds ago, I just basically referred to Cortez as an irredeemable person, right? Not everybody in history actually is irredeemable. There are some, right? In the 20th century, there are some. But I do appreciate the fact that that's the argument that we're being called to here. And I really feel this episode drags you into that a lot more, because you see how Khan is acting in more of a day-to-day sense, how he's leading his people, how he's making decisions, who he's making that decisions with, all very, very dynamic. They flesh Khan out. He is becoming a not just three-dimensional, but I would say four-dimensional character, because we're getting all of this time, you know, what Starfleet and what Starfleet society thinks of him versus the movie and television show we've seen him in before. There's so much to him here. He is fleshed out very well.
Well, let's jump right to that then. We kind of have a lot to set that up, but let's just jump into that discussion then.
Just dive right in.
We talk a little bit about Marla's goals here. And one of them is to write this biography of Khan and really explain him in a way that, like, she has come to know him through history books and now firsthand. And to me, the most interesting part of this is where she brings that idea to Khan and says, you know, I want to tell the truth about who you are and what you've done. And Khan is not really on board. He basically says, what if the truth doesn't serve me? What if the truth gets in the way of my goals and what I want? And maybe I don't want you to, like, he doesn't say this in so many words, but basically it's, maybe I don't want you to explain me. I don't want to be explained. I am Khan. I don't need to be explained. I will rule. That's what I will do. Mm-hmm. It's interesting. And I really liked, you're put in the place of Marla and frustrated by what he's saying back, because wouldn't you want to explain yourself? Wouldn't you want the world to know and be on your side? He's like, no, I don't really, that doesn't serve me.
You know, it's funny. There are characters in history that, as a person who loves history, I've wanted to kind of exonerate and do more to condemn, right? I've already talked about Winston Churchill. I'm going to keep on the list here. And I came across, so I used to teach grade 12 social studies, and I came across a CIA document that came out right after the death of Stalin. And we paint Stalin in a very super dark, purely villainous, that's it, blah, blah, blah. He was a monster. That's all, right? You've ever watched or listened to Behind the Bastards? He's on that. He's an irredeemable character, as bad, if not worse, than Cortez. Well, here's what the CIA had to say about him. I'm just going to read a couple lines here. This is after his death. It says, even in Stalin's time, there was collective leadership. The Western idea of a dictator within the communist setup is exaggerated. Misunderstandings on that subject are caused by a lack of comprehension of the real nature and organization of the communist power structure. Stalin, although holding wide powers, was merely the captain of a team, and it seems obvious that Khrushchev, his replacement, I will say there, will be the new captain. And so in that respect, I wanted to set the record straight. I wanted people to realize that he was an ally in the Second World War and that we weren't always fighting Russia and all of these sorts of things. And then, I don't know, the ghost of Stalin just sort of floated through my brain one day and said, who cares, Barry? I'm a larger-than-life person who did a lot of stuff, good and bad. And like, that's the thing, is I wasn't trying to say he didn't do bad things. Of course he did. Mm-hmm. So did Churchill, and especially so did Hitler. But this is the thing, is Khan's response to Marla is, I think, again, something that a real world controlling leader would say, of like, why are you trying to turn me into just a man? I'm more than a man. I'm an institution, lady. Like, and I know that. I know that I'm more than anything, and that's why I'm here. So you can cut it out, actually.
Yeah. It's interesting because I feel like we frame the quote unquote great men of history as men of ego. Right. Mm-hmm. We assume that because they were known the world over, they wanted to be known the world over. They wanted, you know what I mean? And it's interesting to reframe Khan as somebody who couldn't give two farts about what the world cares about. He does have ego. I think especially after what's to come, I think that kind of changes a lot about him. At this point here, he certainly believes in himself, and he believes that he is superior to everyone around him, but he doesn't care if you fawn over that fact or not. He accepts that in his mind as the truth. Mm-hmm. And if you don't believe that, well, I don't care. Screw you. Like, I will run you over. I don't really give two wits. I don't care if you fall on your knees and cry and, you know, all of that stuff. Just follow me or get out of my way.
Yeah. Yes. And kind of thing. Right. I think it's a wake up call for a lot of us, because, you know, people who we hold in such high regard or otherwise as sort of evil, especially if they're gone now, don't care. Mm-hmm. You're not going to be able to convince anyone either. And I think that's the other piece of it. If Starfleet believes, and if Starfleet Society and the United Federation of Planet Society believes Khan is a monster, then he's a monster. like, like we've kept on saying, history is a reflection of the present, right? We exonerate people and we condemn people based on the values of our society. And Khan, I think, realizes he transcends that, right? He first of all, was involved in Earth's history. He shows up in Earth's quote unquote future, and now he's in a completely different planet. So say what you want about me.
Well, let's set up what's actually going on in this episode. We learn that it's day 29 of their exile. It's about 3 weeks after the previous episode, because Khan at one point says, you know, she's basically not talked to me for 3 weeks. So we get a little bit of a time frame there. But Khan's going to lead this scouting party that's going to go out and be out in the wilderness for a couple weeks, basically. And he intends to bring MacGyvers with them. The motivation for Khan to do this is interesting, because there's a couple of things. I think he's eager for her to prove herself in the eyes of the people around him. But also, there's some very human stuff going on with Khan, where he's frustrated that she's frustrated with him. And he wants to get her back on side. And he kind of doesn't really understand why. It's like, I'm building a great thing here, and she has a part to play. I don't get why she has a problem with that.
Don't you want me, baby? Right? I like that he's vexed by her, I think. And to be vexed by a person typically means you have feelings for them. And yeah, him dragging her along obviously helps the story and helps the plot, but it also does kind of act as a bit of a foil to what he says about her earlier when he's caught her with the communicator, right? Mm-hmm. That ultimately there is actually more than her just being a potential backup to the breeding program he wants to get started. He does care for her. He loves her. And what did he say? There was something about, like, I can't abide by her frustration with me or something like that. He's like, there's just something I can't abide by it. And it's like, yeah, it's because you want the girl you like to like you back, you know?
Yeah.
I like that. It's believable because it's Khan's take on it, right? He's not saying she gives me a funny feeling in my tummy. He's like, she's frustration with me frustrates me, you know? And I like that.
Yeah. And now, so for the character of Marla MacGyvers, this is what I was alluding to earlier. The writers have done this brilliant thing where they actually glommed onto the tiny bit of agency that she does show in Space Seed. And they kind of bring it front and center here, where she talks about her two betrayals, right? Yes. So there's the most recent one, but also, like, in the last episode, but also in Space Seed, where Khan is torturing Kirk in the decompression chamber and Marla lets him out. And this serves as a betrayal of Khan in his mind. And she says, that was not me betraying you. That was you betraying me. I said that I will go along with what you want to do, but I will not allow you to hurt them. And you ignoring me is not a betrayal by me. It's a betrayal of me. And I loved that, because that is the little bit of agency she does show in that episode. And it's great that they confronted it here, because that was always one thing that she kind of thwarts Khan's plans by letting Kirk out in that moment. But Khan is still kind of happy to take her along with him to SETI Alpha 5. So I'm glad we get that kind of confronted here, and it plants in your head the one thing that she did do back in the day that kind of shows her assertiveness in the face of Khan, right? So
yeah,
well done to the writers there.
Yeah, and also in terms of the battle of wits here, Khan is a brilliant tactician. He took over so much. He has always fought well and was only bested by Kirk, but actually I think he got bested by Marla here too. He's a little clueless when it comes to understanding intention. And I think that's something that maybe we'll see with some of the characters on SETI Alpha 5, Ivan especially. I think Ivan's got some interesting pieces here. He, even when Khan when Khan leaves, at the end, he says, you know, Ivan, you can be the strong hand to carry us forward and stuff like that. And as much as Ivan's done so much for Khan so far, I do feel like they're setting something up there again, another thread, because yeah. Ivan is a very, the only way out is through kind of guy. And Khan doesn't always do it that way, right? He is a lot more calculating, and that has been successful and a failure. And sometimes Khan doesn't read people well, seeing how he hasn't read Marla well.
Yeah. And Ivan, yeah, I think you're right. They're setting some things up here. He is a man of huge appetites, literally and figuratively.
Yeah.
In some cases, it really feels like he is a bit of the face of unfettered expansionism and consumption almost. Mm-hmm. Yeah. And I'm wondering if like that will be a snake or the snake in this Garden of Eden that they have here, right? Like, mm-hmm. will he be the, I mean, there's already a lot of corruption in this group to begin with, but will he be the thing that really corrupts the society going forward?
Yeah, exactly. To really shift gears here, but I'm just interested in your thoughts about this. They definitely play it up. And I mean, in the previous episode, they get a bunch of animals from the ocean and eat them. And I was kind of like, are you testing these things? what if you eat something poisonous? What if you get a little tiny octopus and it kills you? Right. But they kind of lace that in to say like, oh, wow, these animals have sort of evolved along very similar lines that on Earth. And I mean, how convenient. I mean, but also Kirk would have picked the right planet. But what are you thinking about that?
I had a couple thoughts about that. That was actually something I was thinking of putting in the notes, because part of me wonders, and I can't imagine this is definitely the case, but like part of me wonders if that's a holdover from the original script, because like that is almost like verbatim what they would say in an episode of Stargate to kind of explain why every planet looks like, you know, Western British Columbia. So part of me was wondering like, oh, this was going to be a televised miniseries and they were looking to save as much budget as they could. That was one of the reasons why it never went forward. Mm-hmm. I wonder if that line was like in there to, you know, explain why they're just shooting, you know, in California or Ontario or whatever, right? And everything. It's like, oh, this place has evolved very similarly to Earth. And I'm like, it's a podcast. You don't need to do that.
Yeah, but, why'd you do that? Why'd you even say that? But yeah. I love how that also gets them into calling them like not deer and, you know, not berries and stuff.
Which led to one of my favorite lines in the episode where Khan says, we will not let this place be defined by what it is not.
Yes.
You know, you, Erica, will name these things and let's not call them not antelope and, you know, not
setidactyls.
Setidactyls.
Love it.
Again, though, still rooted in the Terran way of naming things, which is interesting, but you can never get away from it fully.
Yeah, not quite.
But along with the setidactyls and these not boars, we have the Seti eel, this just introduced by Khan in Star Trek II, The Wrath of Khan, as at that time, Seti Alpha 5's solely remaining indigenous life form after the disaster, right? So this is the creature whose larva will make its way into Chekhov's brain and will apparently be the cause of the death of Khan's wife, according to Star Trek II.
Knowing all of that just gives me the creepy crawlies. When I was a little kid, the Seti eel was just, oh, I couldn't handle it. Going into your ear and ugh.
Yeah.
I hate it.
Ugh. Yeah, I'm not a fan either, for sure.
Yeah. Also, those parasites in the Star Trek The Next Generation where they blow up that guy's head, that was also a bad one. But yeah.
Yeah. What put it more recently to this television series Expanse, when they were on that planet and the little slugs would just like drop onto their face and they'd immediately die. And you're like, oh my God.
Yeah, that one got me too. And they're going blind and stuff like that.
Oh, yeah. That was brutal. And I mean, like, talk about the most realistic depiction of what probably stepping into an alien biosphere would do to a body, right?
Season 4 of The Expanse was an extremely good shake of the Etch-a-Sketch to kind of get us out of the pattern. And that little, the season in a box. Wow. What a, And this actually, you know, this is an episode in a box, I find. A very nicely contained. And again, though it, like, at first it feels like an expansive forest, and by the end it feels like a greasy, claustrophobic jungle.
Yeah, this show is doing so much to set mood and tone, and it is swinging wildly from unfettered optimism to, oh my God, what have we gotten ourselves into here?
Joe Bluth, I've made a huge mistake.
Yeah. Well, we get another death in this episode with Joaquin, who, of course, was probably the biggest character of the augments in Space Seed besides Khan, in that, you know, he had a name and we saw him for a few seconds. But he is killed by this huge boar-like creature, set up seemingly as retribution for killing one of like possibly its mate. Or something like that.
Earlier. Sentient.
Possibly, right? You wonder.
More so. Well, even Khan's response, right? I ordered the kill, blah, blah, blah. Take me, you know, and stuff like that. And the boar goes after him, you know?
Yeah.
And then just this flurry of gunfire and chaos. And I almost spilled my chamomile tea on myself. It was the whole thing.
So this is leading me to wonder if what we're going to be seeing is kind of the death by a thousand cuts until the big disaster comes, right? Because in episode 1, we started with 73 people and ended the episode with 72. And now episode 2, we end with 71 people. Like, it feels like they're just getting little nicks and cuts here. And it's going to be kind of scrabbling to survive a little bit, which in this state, in the way it is right now, kind of almost serves Khan's purpose, right? This taming of this world, this, you know, this kind of conquering this world and building an empire upon it. And rewatching Space Seed and that little bit at the end where Kirk says, you know, it would be interesting to return here in 100 years and see what has grown from the seed that has been planted today. I kind of almost regret that we would never see that because of what happened in Star Trek II, The Wrath of Khan and before that. Like, it would be really interesting if suddenly there was this empire in the heart of Federation space that's starting to rise or something, you know, like what society would have grown from this place? This one of seemingly egalitarianism and, I don't know. Like it's, there's enough of a question of Khan's character that it has me wondering now, like, would that have been bad or would that have been a good thing?
You're giving me stuff that absolutely. No, you're right. Like what, I guess that's how tragedies work though, right? What if Romeo and Juliet ran away together, right? Like it's that kind of thing. Like, what if Jack and Rose got off the Titanic together? Like, I guess that's why we like tragedies, is we know how this ends. And like, taking us back to Strange New Worlds, I mean, like, I'm riveted to watch the next season, but I know how this ends. And we even got a little taste of what it might be like had the accident not happened to Pike now too, right? We even got a little tease. I appreciate your point. I appreciate what you're saying because I guess, another thing I hadn't really thought about. And also I love the fact that you are going to keep a kill count going for us, apparently.
I didn't intend to, but it occurred to me as I was writing these notes. I'm like, huh, interesting.
Well, and I think you're right, because what would make a person mad? What would make Khan so incredibly angry and just frenetic in his lust to kill, after all of this, his worst base instincts now taking control of him? We do see the good side of him here, absolutely. And I think you're right, we're gonna watch a man's good side get slowly picked away. while things get worse and worse and worse.
Yeah. And it should be noted, this was at the end of the previous episode and not this one, but I neglected to mention it. We get the meteor shower. Yes. And part of me was wondering in that moment is like, is this already happening now? Is this the cataclysm? And no, it's not yet, but it's there's signs and portents, right? Like,
yep. Goodness.
I love the dramatic irony of this. I love that, like you said, the tragic aspect of it, that we know where this is going. And oh man, it's going to be a heartbreaking journey to get there. And I was not anticipating being heartbroken seeing Khan and his followers suffering, but like, it's going to break my heart a little bit. And I think I'm surprised by that, but pleasantly so.
I feel very much like at the end of all of this, you and I need to watch Star Trek II: The Wrath of Khan and see how it changes us a little bit. I mean, I'll always kind of have how I feel about that movie in my head forever. But I think this will give a lot of us an opportunity to, if we choose to, watch that movie with a new set of eyes.
If we had all the time in the world, I would like, you know, a full day of Space Seed, 9 episodes of Star Trek Khan, and Star Trek II: The Wrath of Khan.
I mean, I wouldn't see any downside to that. We could make some food.
I think it might be great.
Let's do a 9-hour live episode of us watching every single and listening to. No.
I mean, that sounds brilliant, but
self-serving.
So, Barry, I guess final thoughts on these two episodes, and what are you anticipating seeing? What do you want to see? Where do you think things are going to go from here beyond what we know?
Well, like I said, I'm very happy with this. This has been some really good Trek. I think we've 2025 is going to go down as a year for some very interesting and fun Star Trek. I think that we're going to see Khan's pragmatic side get tested more and more. I think he's going to have to make some difficult decisions like he probably had to in the past. I think that we are going to see this paradise, right? As the first episode says, I think we're going to see this paradise really rear its ugly head. I hope they don't take it in a full-on Jurassic Park, there's monsters in the woods kind of thing. I hope that's just a slice of it. I hope that there's more, you know, fear the people you're with rather than fear the threat from outside. And I think that's the direction they're going to go with this. Mm-hmm. And like I said, something about Ivan, he's going to be trouble. He is Barney Rubble. He's got trouble written all over him for me. And he's going to come, and it's going to be difficult for Khan to spot, because I'm already realizing Khan is a master tactician. He's an extremely good orator, but the people closest to him, he does not read well.
I think that's brilliant too, because that's almost a character trait that they latched onto in The Wrath of Khan, right? Mm-hmm. Where he sees the big picture, he sees grand tactics and movements, but he misses the little things, the things right in front of him, right? The three-dimensional thinking that Kirk exploits, right?
Exactly.
He misses the things right under his nose a little bit.
Absolutely.
And I think that's brilliant.
Absolutely.
Ivan, I agree. There's just too many little postscripts, little asides with him making little comments that I'm like, oh, he's trouble. I don't like him. He is absolutely going to be some sort of snake in the grass for sure. But I'm curious to see what all comes of this, not just for the folks on SETI Alpha 5, but also for Dr. Lear and the discoveries that she will be making as well aboard the Excelsior going through all of this too. I'm interested to see some kind of ripple effects from that as well for the framing story. So
yeah. I kind of forgot about them through this episode a little. I got really tied up in it. So yeah.
Yeah. Well, I hope you will all join us in 2 weeks' time for an episode dealing with the next two episodes, episode 3 and 4. We will be talking about that in an upcoming episode. Until then, thank you all so much for joining us. We really appreciate it. Live long and prosper. And of course, stay positive. Positively Trek is produced and edited by me, Dan Gunther, and co-produced by Barry DeFord on Treaty 8 territory, the home of the Beaver, Cree, Dene, and Métis people, whose histories, languages, and cultures we respect. We acknowledge the many First Nations, Métis, and Inuit who have lived in and cared for these lands for generations.
Listen up, football fans. You won't want to miss this.
Right now, new Bet365 customers bet $5 and get $200 in bonus bets, win or lose. So you could turn that $200 into something bigger when you bet on Moneyline, Spread, Totals, Player Props.
$200 in bonus bets when new customers bet $5. I know where I'm going to bet from now on. Download the app today and see why it's never ordinary at Bet365. Gambling problem? Call 1-800-GAMBLER. 21 plus only. Must be physically located in Ohio. T&Cs apply. In app only.